Hello and welcome to Patriotic History. Today's date is Friday the 11th of March 2022 and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, streaming at RadioAlbion.com. Today is episode number 30 in our series. Last week we were talking about legends and the legend of Albion and the myths associated with Britain, and this week we're going to be looking at the archaeological record. And as always, I have with me my co-host, the Patriarch from the Patriotic Arts Community. Patriarch, good day, sir. How are you doing?
Yeah, I'm very well. I'm very well, thanks. How are you?
Very good, very good. The last episode was actually delayed. It didn't actually go out for a couple of weeks because we had the PA update and we had the PA stream analysing Nick Fuentes. So it's actually been a couple of weeks since we recorded. But as I say, this week it's going to be slightly different to the last episode anyway, because we're going to look at the archaeological record and how that ties in with what we know from the mythical history that we have. And I know this is something that you wanted to get into for a while, talking about the migrations and the early humans or humanoids and how they fit into this. So we're going to be looking at that this week. And we'll begin. Fossils of very early Neanderthals dating to around 400,000 years ago have been found at Swanscombe in Kent, and of classic Neanderthals about 225,000 years ago at Pont Newydd in Wales. Britain was unoccupied by humans between 180,000 and 60,000 years ago, when Neanderthals returned. And I'm taking these notes from Wikipedia, and I would question that, because the use of this term human for them is entirely inaccurate. A human being is a humane being, and we have no way of knowing if these creatures were humane or not. They bear superficial similarities to us in that they walked on two legs, but that's about it. And they should really be referred to as humanoids rather than humans. I mean, what they're basically doing here is that they're trying to claim that we evolved from these creatures before us, and that there's actually no evidence for that. All we know about them is they walked on two legs. It doesn't mean that we came from them.
Yeah, I mean, I wonder, by the definition of a humane being at the time, what would have been the criteria for a humane being? Would it have been someone that was obviously civilized? People that were obviously civilized had the ability to have language as well. And that, I guess, these were the kind of factors that we should be using to grade them against.
Definitely, yeah. And they would have had charity, mercy, justice. I mean, all these things are associated with the word humane. And we can't just look at creatures and say, well, they walked on two legs, they must have been humane beings. As we've been looking at this, civilization really came about alongside the first evidence that we have of white people on Earth. Mm-hmm. And these Neanderthals certainly weren't white a quarter of a million years ago. They know nothing about them. They just have a few bones. And from that, they say, well, they must have walked on two legs. These must be our ancestors. And we also know, as we've covered in depth, there's been all these migrations of different people types moving around across the world. So just because there were Neanderthals in Britain a quarter of a million years ago does not mean that the people today were descended from them. I mean, the people today moved here from elsewhere. And if you just move to a country, you don't dig in the ground and then think, oh, well, that must be my ancestors, because you have a record that you moved to that country from somewhere else. And we have records that we migrated into Britain, and we have the Greek records that say that Europe was pretty much unpopulated. There were some people that were living on the coastlands, and that was about it. And the centres of civilization were exactly where you would expect them to be, in the areas where it was easiest to live, the most fertile areas, the Fertile Crescent, which is now desert, basically.
Yeah, I think also to make that connection of ancestry, you'd like to think that there's other confluencing factors as well, such as, I know, cultural elements and things like that. But I think going that far back, there clearly wasn't an essence of culture at all. So, which again proves that there wasn't kind of a humane element to them.
Well, that's it. We have to look at the culture and civilization as well to know that these people were the same as us. By 40,000 years ago, the Neanderthal humanoids had become extinct, and modern humans had reached Britain. By modern humans, they mean something different to anything around today, but has more than just superficial similarities. So we know that these used tools, but they are really still just humanoids. Even their occupations were brief and intermittent due to a climate which swung between low temperatures with a tundra habitat and severe ice ages which made Britain uninhabitable for long periods. The last of these ice ages, the Younger Dryas period, ended around 11,700 years ago. And since then, Britain has been continuously occupied by humanoids, but white men did not arrive until much later. Britain and Ireland were at that time joined to the continent, so the terrain looked entirely different. So did the geography. The country was not even an island, so we should not really even be referring to it as Britain, the same as it is wrong to refer to Africa tens of thousands of years ago. Rising sea levels cut the land between Britain and Ireland by around 11,000 years ago, and we became similar to an island, but there was still a large plain between Britain and continental Europe known as Doggerland, which persisted for much longer, probably until around 5,600 BC. And that's an interesting name there, Doggerland. And this is a pet peeve of mine about Africa, when they say, oh, we all came out of Africa a quarter of a million years ago. Africa didn't exist back then. I mean, the continents were all up tight together. You can see that. If you look at a map of the world and you look at the outline of the continents, you can see that they've broken off from one another, basically. They make a perfect fit to one another. So they broke apart, and there was no country that was called Africa back then. We don't know what the climate was like.
True. Yeah. It would have been very different environmental, just environmental factors. And yeah, it would have been totally different. And also the sea levels may have risen over time as well to define some of the borders.
Well, it also shows this, you know, this fear about climate change is unfounded. You know, the climate is constantly changing without, you know, without the effect of humans on it changing it. It's to do with the sun. I think the poles have swapped around as well at different times.
Yeah, quite possibly. Okay. I wonder. Do you know much about Doggerland? I've heard some people say that it might have been Atlantis.
Yeah, that is what some people say, that could have been Atlantis back then. But what's there? I mean, I'm not sure what's there. I know that we do have remains of Roman settlements that are actually out there at sea that are now covered with the sea.
Wow, really?
Yeah.
So how long ago was Doggerland kind of at the surface as opposed to submerged underwater?
Well, it says here 5,600 BC.
Right. So that's not too long ago, is it? Really,
not that long ago. But when you go along the coasts of Britain and you see that seawall there, that's there to prevent the sea from coming in. You can already see parts of Britain where the houses are falling into the sea. People have had to move back, and there are settlements that are actually out there at sea where the sea is working its way in. It's just something that happens. The water moves back or it rises depending on what happens with the climate.
Yeah.
Located at the fringes of Europe, Britain received European technological and cultural developments much later than Southern Europe and the Mediterranean region did during prehistory, according to conventional historians. And this is because of the temperature. So in Southern Europe, it's close to the Fertile Crescent. You've got the Levant, which is over there. You've got the civilizations that were over there. And in Britain, what you basically had was mining. You didn't have cities and suburbs that were being built in Britain. You had the mining that was going on there. And we were actually more advanced than the rest of them by a later period. By around 4000 BC, the island was populated by people with a Neolithic or Stone Age culture. this Neolithic population had significant ancestry from the earliest farming communities in Anatolia. And Anatolia is, again, it's right next to the Fertile Crescent. That's what is now Turkey. That's where Troy is. That's where the Hittite Empire was, is Anatolia. So the people that actually came into Britain, their ancestry goes back to that area that we've been talking about in the earlier episodes. And this indicates that a major migration from the Near East of white people accompanied farming and farming techniques. The beginning of the Bronze Age and the Bell Beaker culture was marked by an even greater population turnover, this time displacing more than 90% of Britain's Neolithic ancestry in the process. This is documented by recent ancient DNA studies, which demonstrate that the pioneers had large amounts of Bronze Age Eurasian steppe ancestry, associated with the spread of Indo-European languages, and the same people group responsible for the Yamnaya culture, which sprang out of nowhere around 3300 BC, the same time period as they claim that the Bronze Age began in Mesopotamia. And of course, they look at the Yamnaya culture and they say, well, there were people living there before the Yamnaya culture, but quite clearly it wasn't the people that were living there beforehand that actually had this culture, because it doesn't evolve from anything. They just suddenly have the techniques for making bronze and civilization and all these things appear. So it had to be migrants that moved into that area, and then from that area they, or other migrants of the same people type, came into Europe, all sharing this same ancestry, basically.
Yeah.
Because the Yamnaya culture is closer to Europe, they say, well, it must have come from there. But really, it came from that central bit.
So they must have branched out then from the Indus Valley and Mesopotamia region, because I know that, I mean, it's around about the same time, but one must have begot the other, right?
Yeah. I mean, it must be people moving out around the world, colonizing the world, and bringing the technology with them, basically. That's how it happens, and replacing the people that were there before. I mean, they replaced the people that were in that part of the world where the Yamnaya culture appeared. They replaced the people that were there before, but we're told, oh no, they must have been their ancestors, but it can't have been. Otherwise, there would have been a gradual increase in the technology that they had, rather than it just suddenly appearing.
Yeah, true.
No official written language of the pre-Roman inhabitants of Britain is known, although some historians cite the existence of the Colburn alphabet, which is mentioned by historians and geographers of the era, because they do talk about the British having their own alphabet. There is also evidence of Ogham writing preceding Roman times in Ireland. Because mainstream historians ignore references to Britain by Greek, Latin, Phoenician, and biblical authors, the history, culture, and way of life of pre-Roman Britain is claimed to be known mainly through archaeological finds. And we're going to look, as I say, we're looking at the archaeological finds this week, but we're also going to look at the references to Britain by these ancient authors as well. Archaeological evidence, however, demonstrates the truth of those accounts, that ancient Britons were involved in extensive maritime trade and cultural links with the rest of Europe from the Neolithic onwards, especially by exporting the tin that was in abundant supply and required to fuel the Bronze Age in the Near East. Although the main evidence for the period is archaeological, available genetic evidence is increasing, and views of British prehistory are evolving accordingly. Julius Caesar's first failed invasion of Britain in 55 BC, where he hardly made it past the beach before being sent packing back to Gaul, is regarded as the start of recorded proto-history, although some historical information is available from before then. And quite clearly, if we were able to defeat Caesar and send the Roman Empire going back to Gaul, we were quite a force to be reckoned with here in Britain.
Yeah. And obviously, touching back on the language, Cauldron, we mentioned Colburn in the last episode, I think, that has very close ties to Phoenician alphabet and Paleo-Hebrew, right?
Yeah, it looks like a cross between Phoenician and runes, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah, you can see it on I think it's the Frank's casket. You've got Colburn writing on that, and it turns up in lots of places, and they just say, oh, it's an unknown alphabet.
So essentially, what we can take from that is that the peoples that were there to defend against Julius Caesar's first attempt would have likely have been the earliest settlers that were fomenting the tin trade, and they arrived there via the Mediterranean trade routes, and that explains, you know, their connection to ancient Phoenicia and essentially, you know, ancient Hebrews and that.
Well, we've actually, by that time, we've actually got Brutus, the Trojan prince who came over to Britain, and we've got the legends about him, which we will look at next week. The tin trade goes back even earlier. I mean, the tin trade goes back to, I think, they say that it goes back to about 2200 BC, I think it is. Whereas the Bronze Age, they say, began in 3500 BC in the Near East. But the Bronze Age could not have begun in the Near East without the tin coming from Britain. So it may be that the Bronze Age didn't actually begin until much later than 3500 BC. Because a lot of this, they base on Egyptian records. And if they've got the Egyptian records wrong, then everything else is going to be wrong. Their dating for everything else is going to be wrong. And that there is confusion over the dates of the Trojan War, because when we look at the records of it, it implies that it must have taken place about 700 BC.
Okay.
But then the official date for it is 1200 BC, 1100, 1200 BC. So, and that's because the official date for it is based on the Egyptian chronology. And the Egyptian chronology, a lot of historians say, is actually out. But because they decided that that was fixed and they were going to base everything else from this Egyptian chronology, it's meant that it's been out ever since. I mean, Alan Smith and Baron Blackett, they place the Albion migration at 1600 BC. And they claim that was at the time of the height of the Bronze Age in Mesopotamia, which the official historians claim was about 700 or 800 years previous to that. So when we go back millennia, it's very difficult to actually be specifically accurate on the time that we're talking about, which is just one of these things, I guess.
Yeah.
And that's why it's important to look at the written record and the legendary record, as well as the archaeological record, and try to tie it all in there. But there's also political reasons why they don't want us to think that Britain had a civilization before Julius Caesar arrived. And it's the same reason why they don't want us to think the Welsh really amounted to anything before the Saxons arrived. Although, you know, that is a nonsense when you actually look at the record, because Alfred the Great had to go to Wales to get teachers to teach the Saxons how to read and write. So obviously in Wales, they had a higher standard of civilization than they actually had in England, than the Saxons had. And yet they make out that the Welsh really didn't know anything. And clearly the Welsh did, because they defeated Julius Caesar, because the Welsh were the same people back then as the ancient Britons, basically. So if I talk about ancient Britons, when I talk about the ancient Welsh or the Cymry, it's all the same people that were in Britain before the Saxons and before the Romans.
Right, okay.
And if you think they'd been there with these tin mines, then obviously they're going to be, you know, fairly advanced by this time. And I think they were advanced when you look at the megaliths that they put up, the dolmens and the stone circles and the standing stones. I mean, you have to have a certain level of technology to be using huge, great stones like that and moving them about. They still don't know how that was done. They still don't know how they got the stones for Stonehenge from Wales to Somerset. Huge, great sarsen stones.
How do they know they got them from Wales?
Because it's the same rock type. In the Preseli, they've got a blue stone, which is called a blue stone, which is found in Preseli, Wales, and in South Wales, and somehow those great rocks managed to make their way to Somerset to be used in Stonehenge. And there is a theory that it could have been glaciers that took them. And then as the glaciers receded, it left those rocks there in Somerset. But there are other theories that the ancient Britons tried to use timber, and they rolled them on timber logs and then tried to float them along the rivers. And they actually tried to do that about 10 years ago. They actually tried to do that and they completely failed. They just couldn't do it. It was too much for them. They had, hundreds of people and they just could barely move it a few miles. So they just don't know how it was actually done with the technology that they had back then. Horses or whatever. Perhaps we had elephants here. We do know that the Romans brought over elephants, battle elephants, which would obviously terrify the horses. Well, few, if any, settlement sites have been definitively found before the 4th century BC, although historians will quote dates from this time as if they were an authority on it. It is very difficult to date the exact time that stones were arranged together or fence posts hammered into the ground. Because of this lack of evidence for human habitation, they claim that we were living in cold, dark caves at this time. And this is because of this idea that we must have been the descendants of the people that were living here beforehand. So because there is no evidence of people actually living here at that time, they say, oh, well, they must have been living in the caves, in the cold, dark caves. As if we'd be living in cold, dark caves when there was a nice, warm part of the earth that we could be living in the Fertile Crescent. I mean, it doesn't make sense that we would do that. What does make sense is that we would spread out from the civilization would start in the warm areas, and the people from that civilization would then spread out from there looking for resources and make their way to the colder areas where they found the resources, set up a small settlement where they do mining and what have you, and then send all the resources back to the central civilization in the Near East. And that's what we find. And that's really what the historical record tells us as well, that there were a few people living on the coasts, and the Phoenician ships would come to Britain and they would pick up the tin from there. And there was also amber that would be picked up from the Baltic, because we have evidence of people there in the Baltic as well.
Mm-hmm.
The construction of the earliest earthwork sites in Britain began during the early Neolithic, which we are told is 4,400 BC to 3,300 BC, but is probably much later, beginning around 3,000 BC, judging by the time we appear in the Near East with the technological know-how necessary to survive in the North. Because you also have to understand the stars and the magnetic compass, and you have to know how to navigate to actually get here. And then you have to have the technology for warm clothing. You have to have the technology for preserving food, all sorts of things you need to actually live in the North. I think this idea that anything could evolve in the North, it doesn't really make sense, because if you look at a human baby, how is that going to survive in an icy cold winter? It can't.
Yeah, true. Yeah, exactly. I mean, even if you've camped outside, it's so easy for frost and cold to just set into the bones. You'd have to have really a very well, made home, which is essentially kind of centrally heated.
Yeah, you have to have the technology first.
Yeah,
before exactly. getting there, you couldn't just work it out once you got there. These earliest sites take the form of long barrows used for communal burial, and the first causewayed enclosures, sites which have parallels on the continent. The former may be derived from the longhouse, although no longhouse villages have been found in Britain, only individual examples. And again, that shows that the settlements here in Britain, they were sparse, basically. I think they were just there because of the mining and the resources. It wasn't, let's colonize and settle this country, because it wasn't as temperate as the areas that were really fertile. And it was also lots of forest. Like the mainland of Britain was all forests. So you could really only be on the areas that were near the sea, and that's where the tin mines are in Cornwall. They're right down there on the coast. The stone-built houses on Orkney, such as those at Scarborough Brae, are, however, indicators of some nucleated settlement in Britain by a highly advanced people. It is located on the Bay of Scale on the west coast of Scotland, the largest island in the Orkney archipelago, consisting of 10 clustered houses made of flagstones in earthen dams that provided support for the walls. The houses included stone hearths, beds, and cupboards. They even have primitive sewer systems, with toilets and drains in each house, carrying effluent to the ocean with water that was used to flush the waste into a drain. This technology links the people who built this with the same technology being utilized by the great civilizations we covered earlier in the series in the Indus River Valley, Egypt, and Mesopotamia. And if any of the listeners haven't actually seen this before, it really does have to be seen to be believed. It's like the Flintstones house, like a village of where the Flintstones would live. It's Scarborough Brae. And we're told that Scarborough Brae was occupied from roughly 3180 BC to about 2500 BC and is Europe's most complete Neolithic village. Again, I would suggest it was probably later than that, being built around the same time that the tin started to be smelted. The pioneers would have travelled as far north as they could get, seeking minerals, and when they got to Orkney, they may well have stayed to record the constellations there and other astronomical phenomena. It may also have been a lot warmer in Britain during this period. Scarborough Brae has gained UNESCO World Heritage Site status as one of four sites making up the heart of Neolithic Orkney. Older than Stonehenge and the Great Pyramids of Giza, it has been called the Scottish Pompeii because of its excellent preservation. The other four sites there are the Chambered Cairn and Passage Grave, Mace Howe, the Standing Stones of Stromness, and the Henge and Stone Circle known as the Ring of Brodgar. And they are all well worth seeing, even if you just look them up on Wikipedia. The Ring of Brodgar is like a Celtic cross, basically, one of our oldest symbols. And the stones there are absolutely huge. And then you've got this village, which is all made out of stone. If you think at that time, most of us were living in wooden roundhouses. And this is why we don't find a lot of archaeological evidence of the way that we lived, is because it was all made out of timber and timber rots. Basically, it was much more environmentally friendly, basically.
Wasn't there a place in Scotland where there was this kind of underground city carved out of rock?
Well, it might be this that you're actually referring to, because what happened was the sea went back on a spring tide, I guess, or whatever. The sea went back and this just appeared, basically. And it is, as it says here, the earth is pushed up around the outside of the walls. So it does look as if it's underground. If you go to have a look at it, you know, you walk down from the top into the house. It's almost like walking into one of the cairns that have been opened up. You often get cairns that have been opened up, or barrows where they would put burials. And it's like that, only it's a house for living in. And it's quite incredible, you know, with beds and cupboards and a hearth there. But the fact that they used water to flush the effluent away into a drain that then took it to the sea, that shows it was the same people that were doing exactly the same thing in the Indus River Valley. And in Mesopotamia, it had to be. And they were doing it at this time as well. So that shows that we were connected up to them and we were that advanced. And how they can then earlier say that Britain was not so advanced as Southern Europe or what have you, when here this is evidence that we were just as advanced as the Indus River Valley and Egypt. I mean, it proves it, basically. But I guess they just ignore that. A type of runic alphabet appears to have been engraved into the stone lintels and bedposts found in Scarborough Brae that has a resemblance to Culbran. So you can see that as well. that this alphabet we had writing, we don't know what it actually meant, but it's carved into these stone lintels. And they also found these strange balls. They almost look like Boule, the game Boule that you can play. And they've got geometric patterns on them. And they find them in lots of places in Scotland. And they have no idea what they were used for. I mean, some people say, well, maybe they were bearings and they were used when in some way for erecting these megaliths. And other people have said, well, they may have been Plato's solids. It may have been ways to explain what was being taught to children or something. We just don't know what they were. And they've got intricate patterns on them and they're very carefully shaped. And they found them up there as well. And it's believed that the people left there around 2500 BC when the climate started getting cooler. And it may be that this area, when you see the hours of daylight and the hours of dark that it has in the summer and the winter, I mean, that could have been the place where the Book of Enoch, the person that wrote the Book of Enoch, or one of the books of Enoch, was obviously in the north of Europe when he wrote it. And I mean, he may well have been at Skara Brae when he wrote it. I mean, it would have been the most intelligent people that were there. And it could have been an astronomical outpost. I mean, you probably would have also seen the northern lights there, and all sorts of strange phenomena could have been observed in the skies with a clear night sky that was there. And if it was a warmer temperature, so it wasn't as cold as it is now, it all makes sense.
It's quite fascinating. Do you think the, is there any link to Cauldron as a language at all?
Cauldron. Well, it looks like it. It looks similar to the Cauldron alphabet, basically. The carvings that are there on the bedposts. I'd really like to see it, to see it properly rather than just on Wikipedia. Perhaps I will one day. Changes in Neolithic culture could have been due to the mass migrations that occurred around about this time. A 2017 study showed that British Neolithic farmers had formerly been genetically similar to contemporary populations in the Iberian Peninsula. So that's around Spain, and we've also heard that they were the same as the people that were in Anatolia, which was the Hittite Empire. As we know, I mean, it's named Hittite after the sons of Heth, but there were also there were Shemites that were there. We know that Abraham was there. We know that there were Japhethites there as well. So it doesn't mean that they were Canaanites, the fact that it was the Hittite Empire. But from the Beaker culture period onwards, all British individuals had high proportions of steppe ancestry and were genetically more similar to Beaker-associated people from the Lower Rhine area in Germany. The study argues that more than 90% of Britain's Neolithic gene pool was replaced with the coming of the Beaker people. And this may well have been the Albion migration that we talked about last week, coming to the country from Syria, because this steppe ancestry, this Yamnaya ancestry, that was just up above Syria. And we know that, this Albion migration tells us that there was this migration from that area that may well have replaced the people that were here.
So would the, I mean, I was thinking last week they came via the the Mediterranean trade routes, but would they have come through inland as well?
Well, we just know that they set off in ships, basically. They set off in ships with enough victuals for 6 months, which, would have been enough to get here, basically.
Yeah.
But the fact that you have this same technology, these pottery types in the Lower Rhine as well, that links us to the people that were in Germany. Different pottery types, such as grooved ware, appear during the later Neolithic, which is 2900 BC to 2200 BC, again linking these people with the Aryans in the Tarim Basin at this time, not just other people in Europe. If you remember, we tied in this these Beaker people and the type of pottery that they were making. It was the same as the Aryans that were in the Tarim Basin, the Caucasians that were all the way up there. On the way to India in Mongolia, next to China, basically. They had this same technology, and we know what their body type was. So it wasn't just people in Europe that had this same pottery type. In addition, new enclosures called henges were then built, along with the stone rows and the famous sites of Stonehenge, Avebury and Silbury Hill, which building reached its peak at this time. Silbury Hill is the largest man-made hill in Britain. It may be the largest man-made hill in Europe. And that's at the centre of a complex. You've also got Avebury there, which is a stone circle and stone avenues. You've got West Kennet Long Barrow, which is a barrow that's been opened up that you can go into. And then in the same area, you've also got Stonehenge. I mean, it's quite clearly a very central area for the people at that time. And they claim that this was written around, this was built around about 2900 BC to 2200 BC. So the 2200 BC, that would be 600 years before we're dating the Albion migration. But Alan Wilson and Baron Blackett believe that everything is 600 years in front anyway. All these records of when we're told this has happened, really it should be 600 years later, so which would tie in this Albion migration at the time that Stonehenge and Avebury were being built. So the industrial flint mining begins, such as that at Cissbury and Grimes Graves, along with evidence of long-distance trade. So long-distance trade in, I guess, 2500 BC, they're saying. Wooden tools and bowls were common, and bows were also constructed. This would have been 500 years after the Bronze Age supposedly began in Mesopotamia, and 500 years before Wilson and Blackett placed the Albion migration. The migration would have been to a place already known about, as we know the early Assyrians knew of the Tin Island, and the migration may have been a way to introduce a sovereign to rule the country after the settlement had been prepared. If everything took place 500 years after the establishment, historians suggest, that would make the date of 1600 BC for the migration correct, for the evidence of henges and megaliths then being built. So it may have been that they'd been preparing a settlement here, and the Albion migration was to found the settlement, basically, and give the place a name and put a sovereign there, a sovereign ruler, and start off a proper settlement. And we know that because Julius Caesar says that all the nobility of Gaul were educated in Britain, we know that there was a long tradition of education and universities in Britain. So, you know, that would have been around for a long time. People would have been living in Britain and building up their settlements to have that much level of education, and also to be able to defeat Caesar when he got here. And you're effectively saying that the civilization that was in Britain had actually been around for longer than the one that was in, that was in Rome. And this would tie in. Yeah. If we were building these things in 2500 BC or 1600 BC, because Rome didn't really take off, I don't think, until 600 BC, something like that.
Okay.
Then we get to the Bronze Age. This period can be subdivided into an earlier phase, 2300 to 1200 BC, which we covered in the episodes on tin and the Assyrians and the Phoenicians, and then a later period, 1200 to 700 BC, that would tie in with Brutus, which we will talk about next week. Beaker pottery appears in England around 2475 BC to 2315 BC, which we identified as being the same as the pottery in the Tarim Basin and in Austria at the same time. With a revised Stonehenge chronology, this is after the Sarsen Circle and Trilithons were erected at Stonehenge. So, because they started Stonehenge a little bit earlier. Several regions of origin have been postulated for the beaker culture, notably the Iberian Peninsula, the Netherlands, and Central Europe. But the beaker techniques appear at the same time in Britain as the skill of refining metal, so it may well have been brought here with colonisers looking for resources. And don't forget, we also know that they had this in the, you know, this beaker technology in the Tarim Basin. At first, they make items from copper, but from around 2150 BC, smiths had discovered how to smelt bronze, which is much harder than copper, by mixing the copper with a small amount of tin. With this discovery, the Bronze Age arrived in Britain, which means basically bronze items were then found in Britain, or we've found them today. Considering all Britain would have been was a place to get the tin from in order to take it back to the Near East, you would not really expect them to be making bronze items in Britain. That was to be done at the final destination for the tin. So just because we find bronze here at that time doesn't mean that that must have been when the tin mining started. Over the next 1,000 years, bronze gradually replaced stone as the main material for tool and weapon making. Do you want to comment on that at all?
No, I'm okay.
Britain had large, easily accessible reserves of tin in the modern areas of Cornwall and Devon, and as we showed in earlier episodes, had to have been the source used by the civilizations in the Near East, as it was the only area that had tin in the quantities required by them. And if the tin hadn't been provided by Cornwall and Devon, tin would have had the same value as gold because it was that rare. So it had to have come from Cornwall and Devon because that was the only tin that was available in the quantity that was needed to have a Bronze Age civilization in the Near East. And yet the historians won't come to that conclusion. They just say, oh, there must have been some other area that they were getting it from that we haven't found yet. It couldn't possibly have been all the way over there in Britain. And yet I think the archaeological evidence shows that it was.
It makes sense, doesn't it? Obviously trying to conceal. I think when you give credence to one aspect and kind of put a magnifying glass on it, it opens up a whole spectrum of, you know, different ideas and information that emerges out of that, you know.
Well, I think also they don't want us to know that we were connected up with the people in the Near East, because they don't want people to know that the people in the Near East were white. They want people to think that they were the same people group that are living there now.
Yeah, true.
Because otherwise, if you were to say, well, it was the same people group that are there now, you'd be saying, well, why didn't they interbreed with the people of Britain then? Why are we white? If we were the same as the people groups that are there now, clearly they had to have been white because we have remained white. Otherwise, in Britain, we would be looking the same as the people that live in Iraq now.
Yeah, exactly. Well,
by around 1600 BC, the southwest of Britain was experiencing a trade boom as British tin was exported across Europe. And we have evidence of ports being found in southern Devon at Bantam and Mount Batten. And copper was mined at the Great Orme in North Wales. I'm hoping to see that at some point. You know, it's good to actually go and have a look at some of these places and the remains that are there. It helps you to get an idea of what was going on. Looking at the peoples themselves, the Beaker people were also skilled at making ornaments from gold, silver and copper. And examples of these have been found in graves of the wealthy Wessex culture of central southern Britain. It is quite bizarre that they call this the Wessex culture, considering Wessex was an Anglo-Saxon kingdom that did not actually exist for another 2,500 years, and the Beaker people were Celts and not Saxons, although biologically they would have been the same people. So this is one of the ways that they try to discount the Celts or the Cymry or the ancient Britons. You know, they will refer to this as the Wessex culture, as if it was anything to do with the Anglo-Saxons, 2,500 years later. Early Bronze Age Britons buried their dead beneath earth mounds known as barrows, often with a beaker alongside the body. Later in this period, cremation was adopted as a burial practice, with cemeteries of urns containing cremated individuals appearing in the archaeological record, with the deposition of metal objects such as daggers. People of this period were also largely responsible for building many famous prehistoric sites, such as the later phases of Stonehenge and Avebury Stone Circle. The Bronze Age people lived in round houses, and divided up the landscape. And you can actually see the remains of stone roundhouses, but I think that's probably not from this time. The roundhouses that they were making in this time were made out of a timber structure with hide over the top of it. They've built some of them. There are places that you can go and have a look at remade roundhouses. There are some in Cornwall, and there are some in Wales, and get an idea of how we used to live in these big communal houses. Stone rows are to be seen on, for example, Dartmoor, although we don't know for certain that these were used to divide up the landscape. They look more like they were created for ritual purposes, like the stone rows in Brittany, which gets its name from Britain, as the ancient Britons colonised Brittany much later in history. So we have a link between the stones that were being put up in Brittany and the ones in Britain. Well, we have a link with all these megaliths wherever they appear in the world. They were put up by the same people. The dates we are given for these megaliths being built is mainly just guesswork, as it is impossible to say when they were first erected. They ate cattle, sheep, pigs and deer, as well as shellfish and birds, which implies that there were no cities or farms at this time. If you are having to catch food by hunting and fishing, you have to eat what you find, and obviously then you cannot observe the laws on clean and unclean food. So that's why you've got pigs there and shellfish, because you just got to eat what you can find. They carried out salt manufacture, evaporating seawater off to preserve food, and the wetlands were a source of wildfowl and reeds. There was ritual deposition of offerings in the wetlands and in holes in the ground. And we also find people that were executed in the wetlands, in the bogs. And they sometimes, sometimes they'll try and say, oh, it's a human sacrifice. But we have got writings that say that it was execution. I mean, one of the ways that homosexuals were executed were throwing them into the bog. There's a speech by Himmler on homosexuality that cites that, and he's actually citing an ancient Latin author. He used to throw them in the bog.
Into the toilet?
In the bog, so they would drown. Bogland. Bog, like watery, marshy stuff.
The bog is, for me, is like a...
That's a slang term.
Kind of slang term for
toilet. Slang term for toilet, but it originates from the ground.
Toilet.
Yeah, it originates from boggy ground, basically. The bog, marsh. Okay. That's what it means, marshy ground.
Right. I've not used that word in a long time.
You're thinking of the slang term. There has been debate amongst archaeologists as to whether the Beaker people were a race of people who migrated to Britain en masse from the continent, or whether a Beaker cultural package of goods and behaviour, which eventually spread across much of Europe, diffused to Britain's existing inhabitants through trade across tribal boundaries. A 2017 study suggests a major genetic shift in late Neolithic, early Bronze Age Britain, so that more than 90% of Britain's Neolithic gene pool was replaced with the coming of a people genetically related to the Beaker people of the Lower Rhine area. And as we pointed out before, they're also related to the people from the Yamnaya group, the Indo-European group, also related to the mummies in the Tarim Basin. And it's all the same people, and they're bringing their technology with them. And this time, when it replaced 90% of the people that were already here, that would have been the time of the Albion migration, basically.
Yeah.
There is evidence of a relatively large-scale disruption of cultural patterns, which some scholars think may indicate an invasion, or at least a migration, into southern Great Britain around the 12th century BC. Now, this would tie in with the establishment date for the Trojan War and the arrival of Brutus, the Trojan Prince. So this is something that points to the establishment date being correct. This disruption was felt far beyond Britain, even beyond Europe, as most of the great Near Eastern empires collapsed or experienced severe difficulties at this time. And we covered this in our episodes on Moses and Joshua and how Joshua took out the Canaanites. The official story is that the Sea Peoples harried the entire Mediterranean basin around this time, although nobody is quite sure who they were. Increasingly, scholars consider that the Celtic languages arrived in Britain at this time, but other elements of the Celtic cultural package derive from the Hallstatt culture. If the people coming into the country were the same type of people, just separated by their language, they would have the same culture and the same level of technology anyway. So even though this ties in with the date of the establishment date of the Trojan War, it could have been the migration of Brutus. We know that there were migrations before Moses actually left Egypt. We know that there was a big migration of the people, the Hebrews, basically, that left with Zara, and they started the lines in Troy and Rome. And a lot of these kingly lines traced their lines back to Zara instead of Phares. Phares was the one that was born. Well, Zara put his hand out of the womb first and had a red cloth tied around it.
Mm-hmm.
And then Pharaoh was then actually born first, and the Davidic line, King David in the Holy Land, he came from Phares, and then the Trojan line and the Roman lines and the British lines and the Irish lines and most of the early royalty in Europe came from Zara, and Zara and his people left before Moses actually left Egypt. And
there was a point where they weren't talked about anymore in the Bible.
Just got.
Who was it that was likened to Solomon as a renowned man?
Yeah, well, it was two of Zara's sons, Calcol and Darda.
Mm-hmm. Calcol, I think. Yeah.
Yeah, Calcol and Darda, I think, and I think that Calcol is the same as Cecrops in the Greek mythology.
And so, from that line, Brutus came about, but Brutus came after Romulus, right, who set up Rome.
Yeah, well, what you've got is his grandfather was Innes, and Innes married the daughter of Latinus, and they ended up building Rome on these seven hills, and the legend of Romulus and Remus was a legend that was around those hills. And I mean, and there was this, obviously they were suckled by a wolf, I think, and the wolf is to do with the tribe of Benjamin as well.
Yeah.
I believe it's a symbol to do with that. Is it Benjamin is a ravening wolf? So you've got a link there. You've got a link there as well. Perhaps we should have a look at the origins of Rome as well at some point. In 2021, a major archaeogenetics study uncovered a migration into southern Britain during the 500-year period 1300 to 800 BC. The newcomers were genetically most similar to ancient individuals from Gaul and had higher levels of early European or Anatolian farmer ancestry. Anatolia is exactly where the Trojans came from, and they also colonized Gaul, as we will see when we cover the Brutus legend. During 1000 to 875 BC, their genetic marker swiftly spread through southern Britain, supposedly making up around half the ancestry of subsequent Iron Age people in this area, but not in northern Britain, which I guess is where the Picts were. It is not possible to state things like this for definite, since we don't have the remains of all the people here in Britain to check through. What we do is we find a few bodies, and we identify their ancestry, and then we find another few bodies with slightly different ancestry in the north, and from that we somehow get to those few bodies actually representing everyone.
Mm.
You can see where the problems occur, because there isn't that much evidence. The little bit of evidence that we have got, we extrapolate to the entire area.
Yeah.
Which, again, that's why you have to look at the historical record rather than just the archaeological record. The evidence suggests that rather than a violent invasion or a single migratory event, the genetic structure of the population changed through sustained contacts between Britain and mainland Europe over several centuries, such as the movement of traders, intermarriage, and small-scale movement of family groups. The authors describe this as a plausible vector for the spread of early Celtic languages into Britain. There was much less migration into Britain during the Iron Age, so it is likely that the Celtic language had reached Britain before then. The study also found that lactose tolerance rose swiftly in early Iron Age Britain, 1,000 years before it became widespread in mainland Europe, suggesting either that milk became a very important foodstuff in Britain at this time, or that the people that migrated here already had it. And we have to remember here that the Caucasian mummies in the Tarim Basin from 2000 BC, they were also lactose tolerant. So it's basically the same people. It's white people that are all over the place in the Near East, in Britain, in Europe. And in Britain, because we had these mines here, it was a very busy area, and it was built up here before it was really sort of built up in Scandinavia.
You say lactose tolerance, not intolerant.
Yeah, lactose tolerant, meaning that we can we could tolerate milk and cheese. And the Caucasian mummies, they found evidence that they understood the technology for cheese making, because you have to put rennet with the milk. We have a history of butter as well. If you look at the Hindu scriptures, they talk about butter a lot, and Krishna and butter and buttermilk.
Mm-hmm.
And it was only white people that could actually tolerate milk. And, you know, pretty much only white people that could tolerate alcohol. We've had that for a long time. And you know, there's mention of that Noah was the first person to ferment the grape and drink alcohol and work that out. But if you look at groups that have only recently become aware of it, such as Eskimos or Red Indians, I mean, they have awful problems with it. Terrible problems with it, yeah.
Well, like it makes them...
They go crazy.
Or super ill.
Well, like they go absolutely wild on it, and they become addicted to it, and they take it all the time and have all sorts of problems with it. Yeah. But with the lactose intolerance, I mean, the milk will make them ill, whereas we were able to use the milk, so we were able to travel with our cattle and get our milk from the cattle. And butter and all sorts while the cattle were still living, instead of having to just slaughter them for their meat, basically. And we could then also use them for dragging the plough and all sorts of farming uses. And there is a theory that the reason why the Hindus won't eat beef and that it is a sacred meat is because it was their tractor, basically. It was used for so many things. And that's why they don't eat it for beef, because it was used for towing the plough and all sorts of other things. So there's lots to be thinking about there. But basically, what we see there is that the archaeological record does tend to back up the written record that we've been talking about, and there may be slightly different times, but it does show that there were migrations coming into Britain from the Near East, and before then there was nobody here, and so they've had to make up this fantasy that the people that were living here were living in the caves, in the cold dark caves, doing nothing, not leaving any evidence of them living here by, you know, putting up stone circles or anything. And then and then they gradually somehow learned how to the beaker technology, and somehow learned how to make tin and bronze, rather than the people knew how to extract the tin and were coming here for the tin. They came here from the Near East, which is what the written record tells us. You know, the earliest record is of the Assyrians knowing about Britain and getting their tin from Britain. And Assyria is the area that is next to Syria, which is where Albion supposedly came from. And we're told that the earliest genetic markers are from Anatolia, which is just down from Syria, which is part of the Hittite Empire. And then we're told that we've got this later marker, which is also white people, but a later marker that ties in with the people from the steppe, the Yamnaya culture, which is right next to it, and going across Ukraine, I think it is, isn't it, the steppe lands?
Yeah, around the area north of the Caucasus.
Yeah, and we know they're the same people that were in India. They were the Aryans that were in India. And it's the same people that were in this Tarim Basin. But they don't, you know, the official historians, establishment historians, they don't tie it all in together like that. They'll try and say, well, it must have just been people that came here from Spain, because they've got the same genetic markers as the ones in the Iberian Peninsula. And it must have just been these Yamnayas, or these steppe people that brought this into Europe. And they don't say, well, where did those Yamnaya people come from? They can't have been the people that were living there before, because there's no evolving of the technology. It just suddenly appears.
Yeah, progression.
Yeah, and the evidence for the tin mining and all of that, that appears at the same time as there is evidence for people in Britain. But the establishment will try and say, well, we were living in caves evolving from Neanderthals during this period.
Yeah.
Has to be.
That's what they'd have you believe, I guess. But yeah, it's interesting. You have to take, you know, both records, don't you, and kind of overlay them, and then you can see where things fit, and then you can fill in blanks as some of the narratives kind of fill in the gaps here, and vice versa.
And look at the legends, and the myths as well, because there's also kernels of truth in those. But I think we should leave that there for this week, and we'll look at Brutus next week then. So thank you very much for coming on today, Patriarch.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much, listeners, for listening. We will be back next week with another Patriotic History for you. And of course, we do hope you have a great weekend ahead of you.